From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Macomb County's controversial clerk removed from office after 15 tumultuous months.
I would guess that this is going to go down as the most bizarre period of time ever in Macomb County politics.
Ex-offenders fashioning wood, working alongside and mentoring young people in danger of winding up behind bars.
And these guys say it all the time, that working on the wood is like working on themselves.
It's just been a great thing for me because it gives me a sense of pride, feeling I'm giving back to somebody that was potentially going on a wrong path.
And a salute to Black Velvet Art.
Elvis, to Jesus, to the Virgin of Guadalupe, and Marilyn Monroe. We have a Michael Jackson. We have all manner of traditional velvets, and particularly the Aztec legends.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Macomb County Clerk Karen Spranger took office in January 2017, and there has been nonstop drama surrounding her ever since. The drama hit a new high Tuesday when a judge ordered Spranger to be removed from her post. Taking her place will be Kathy Brower, a longtime Macomb County employee. A judge appointed her temporary acting county clerk today. And earlier today, Spranger's deputy clerk Jackie Ryan had to be forcibly removed from her office after she refused to leave. Longtime Macomb County reporter Chad Selweski is here now. Remind us again, Chad, what were the problems and the drama surrounding Spranger right from the get-go?
Yeah, it was within a few weeks of taking office. It had to do a lot with what she assumed her authority was. She thought that she had complete authority over the clerk's office, could hire and fire anybody she wanted, didn't have to work with the Human Resources Department, didn't have to get her budget approved. And it really spiraled out of control from there. By my count, there were 43 incidents in her 15 months in office that involved lawsuits or challenges fired back and forth between her and County Executive Mark Hackle, and bizarre behavior, all kinds of things. But 43 incidents in 15 months, that's that's pretty amazing.
Well, you've covered Macomb County for a long time. Has there been anything like this saga that you can recall?
No. I would guess that this is going to go down as the most bizarre period of time ever in Macomb County politics. And I think that there are more than a few attorneys out there that are surprised at this outcome, because there was a certain school of thought that there's no way a judge is going to remove someone from office barring, you know, embezzlement or something along those lines.
But that happened. So why did the judge remove her from her post as county clerk?
Well, he removed her because she claimed that she lived in this little ramshackle house in South Warren when she filed for office. And when you file for office, you're actually signing an affidavit saying that everything above is true. So that's what the county officials hung their hat on, is that she lied on this document. And I think there are a few things that they came up with in their investigation that showed that there's no way she was living there. At the top of the list, as far as I could see, was that when they went to investigate her house, they couldn't even get in because there was 5 feet of garbage throughout the whole house. They had to use a bulldozer to punch a hole in the exterior to even gain entry.
Yeah, and I believe there was animals and feces and all kinds of nasty things in there. As you said, they couldn't even get the door open.
Yeah.
So that was the final thing, but there's other stuff percolating. I mean, recent accusations she kicked an employee and some questions about a business trip she took.
Yeah, she still has 3 possible criminal cases that could go her way. Kicking the employee is one. I suppose it would be battery. Taking someone who's not an employee on a county junket to a conference in Washington, D.C. County paid for this person to attend. And then the third would be whether they might try to charge her with perjury for signing that affidavit with the idea that she knew that what she was signing was not accurate.
So that we're not done with that. And then was this surprising to you that there was this morning's drama with Jackie Ryan, her deputy clerk, whom I'm guessing is probably the main backer of Karen Spranger within the clerk's office?
Yeah, Jackie Ryan has been considered kind of an oddball in county politics, so her and Spranger made quite a duo. The comical thing about what happened this morning with her refusing to leave is that just last week at an ethics board meeting involving one of Spranger's many controversies, Jackie Ryan argued over and over again that she is not a county employee. She is an appointee of Karen Spranger, and she works for Karen Spranger. So the idea that she refused to leave when Karen Spranger was no longer county clerk is it's pretty interesting, but it kind of fits the pattern.
So, Chad, what was the county officials' reaction when that order was handed down?
It was absolute relief. There were a lot of people that were just beside themselves trying to figure out how to deal with this woman, and it was something that they were just spending a whole lot of time with in court, at county board meetings. The deputy county executive said, it feels like 100 pounds off of my shoulders. So I think he kind of speaks for a lot of people when he said that.
Macomb County reporter Chad Silweski, great talking with you, Chad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Turning shame into pride. That's the idea behind an exhibit of black velvet paintings going on now at the Latino Cultural Center in Detroit's Mexican Town. Elena Herrada is a community activist in Southwest Detroit and co-curator of this exhibit that's titled Black Velvet Art, a Rescuache Aesthetic. It's good to have you with us, Elena.
Thank you.
How did you and your co-curators just come up with this idea for this exhibit?
Well, we had this idea a long time ago. Diana Rivera, who is the curator of the Cesar Chavez Archives at the library at Michigan State University, we were discussing the word rascuache, and to me, the definition that jumped out to me was velvet painting.
I've heard certainly of black velvet art, but I've never heard the word rascuache. What is it, and how does it apply to black velvet paintings?
What it means is basically the idea of people making do. It's particularly a Chicano sensibility. And actually, there's a description coined by the cultural critic Tomás Ibarra Frausto, who theorized that slang term meaning tacky or shoddy or slapdash in a lower class or country bumpkin sort of way. It's kind of an underdog perspective.
Okay. And so what is the history of black velvet paintings? Because I know I remember them from the 50s and the 60s.
Well, you know, that's a good question. And there was really a long, long history of velvet. And there is a museum guide here that also includes the history of it. And our exhibit includes velvets by painters Edgar Leeteg, who reintroduced the medium to the public between 33 and the late 1950s. And then there was mass productions. But there was really velvet going on for years and years before that throughout the world.
And what is it that was so attractive for Mexican-American families?
Well, I think for one thing that it was accessible. And velvet is something that I think it sort of denotes beauty and royalty. Like velvet is really a luxurious fabric in the way that people used it to paint images on, from popular images like bullfighters to Elvis to Jesus to the Virgin of Guadalupe and Marilyn Monroe. We have a Michael Jackson. We have all manner of traditional velvets, and particularly the Aztec legends. And there are several of those in the exhibit. And when people see them, they remember them. They recognize them from their families' homes, their grandparents. It's an art of a great deal of nostalgia also.
This isn't a typical exhibit. I mean, this style of painting doesn't typically have a home in studio. So, you know, who are the artists, and what did it take for you to curate and collect these black velvet paintings?
There's three of us, Diana Rivera and Minerva Martinez, who's in Austin, Texas. And the two of them went to San Antonio, to Mexico. They went to Omaha. They went to different places and found velvet paintings in secondhand stores and the different places that they had collected them from. And they were able to find them and put up a proper exhibit for all the various styles of velvet, from cultural icons to Aztec legends to religious figures.
And are the artists known, or are they anonymous?
Most of them are anonymous. Some of them are known, and they were known also as creating an image and then allowing or authorizing them to be mass-produced, like the bullfighters. So you might see Mendes on many of them. You might see Melendez Garcia. There's a few of them that have names that are known throughout the art houses in Mexico, and then they were mass-produced with permission from the artist.
And this idea, as I looked, read up on this exhibition, that idea of turning shame into pride. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, in the beginning when we first talked about this, there was this reaction that people had when I talked about doing a velvet painting exhibit, and some people would go like, "We don't have any velvet paintings," or "No, I don't have any." So I started this sort of joke about it, like, the first step is admitting you have them. Or some people said that they had them and they were put away. And most people just sort of blew them off like it was an art form that they were way above. Those are the people that probably won't come to the exhibit, but that's okay. This is the exhibit for the people who love this art form. And many people didn't think twice about bringing their own velvets to the exhibit. So it's sort of a gathering of the velvets as well, because people were walking in with velvets in their hand from Bay City, from Saginaw, from Detroit, from Lansing. We've had now two exhibits. The first one was in Lansing, and many people from the Lansing community brought their velvet paintings with them, and they then joined this show. So we started out with about 80, and now we have about 110. And by the time we're finished, we'll probably have more, because there's also original art that people painted on velvet for this show and for the Lansing show. So we're really also restoring the art form of velvet. Actually, we're going to have a workshop with the artist who created new velvet here at this gallery on Saturday the 14th, the day before the exhibit comes down. So the artists who created new work are going to give a little workshop on how they painted on velvet for people who may want to come.
Well, we should let everybody know that black velvet art, a Rascuache aesthetic, will be on display at the Latino Cultural Center at the Mexican Town Welcome Center on Bagley in Detroit. And that will run till April 15th. That workshop that Elena mentioned is on the 14th. And then the exhibit travels to Saginaw, Grand Rapids, and Adrian. So you might pick up more.
We will most likely pick up more. And if you're in a community that wants the exhibit, please get in touch with us.
Co-curator Elena Herrada, we want to thank you so much, and good luck with this exhibit on black velvet art. It was great talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, a company reusing old wood for production and eager to hire workers with criminal records.
Once you give these people the opportunity, the give back is pretty impressive.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Farming has been a key economic component for this state. However, without the life's work of a Michigander from South Haven, farms in Michigan and across the nation might have evolved quite differently. Here now is the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. And Mark, we're talking about somebody that I think a lot of people might not know the name, Liberty Hyde Bailey, but you say you're kind of a Liberty Hyde Bailey groupie?
I admit it. I'm a Liberty Hyde Bailey groupie.
All right. So who is this Michigander who changed farming?
He's been called a man for all seasons. He really was a true Renaissance man. That I think what's interesting about him is he bridged that late 19th century and early 20th century of agricultural development, which, you know, as you know, there was quite a lot of change in those time periods. But as it turns out, his approach to it wasn't always in congruence with the rest of American agricultural thought.
Many people may not have heard of Liberty Hyde Bailey, so let's start with what are some of Liberty Hyde Bailey's best-known legacies?
Notably, he helped create things like extension services at our major land-grant colleges, Penn State, Cornell, Michigan State, 4-H programs. Many people are familiar and participate in 4-H, and also credited with helping establish things like rural free delivery and rural electrification.
All right, so let's start with his childhood. Growing up in South Haven, what was that like?
He was born 160 years ago this month in 1858 in South Haven and had a little bit of a sad childhood. He was the son of a Vermont abolitionist who migrated to Michigan, Liberty Hyde Bailey Sr. He had a couple siblings, a brother and sister, Marcus and Dana, and they all contracted scarlet fever in 1861, and his sister passed that year, and then the next year his mother passed. A bit of a sad childhood, but he still flourished academically right from the get-go, from 5 years old on, to the point where he was named the lead or head ornithologist for the local society there in South Haven when he was still a teenager.
Hmm. And where did he go to college, and what did he study?
He started at the Michigan Agricultural College in East Lansing, later MSU, studying botany under the famous botanist William Beale.
So botany. And what did he have in mind to do with that?
Well, so I might be jumping ahead a little bit because this is the part of him that interests me so much, but he was really interested in the science of botany and how it could help the everyman farmer in America. From MSU, he went on to study under Asa Gray at Harvard, who was the noted botanist of that time period, was there for, I believe, a couple years and did some other things. He was a journalist in Chicago, but when he said he was going back to teach at his alma mater at Michigan Agricultural College, his colleagues at Harvard said, quote, "You'll never be heard from again if you go back there," which turned out to not be true.
So what was significant about what he did? Help us understand why he matters so much in the history of agriculture.
Part of it is just the prolific nature of his research and groundbreaking discoveries in horticulture. It's probably best noted by what he said when he dedicated the first hall of agriculture at Michigan Agricultural College. In his address at that dedication, he said that botanists should jump the garden fence and bring the science of botany into the art of horticulture. You know, that sort of caused a stir because the scientific community didn't want to be dragged down in the dirt, so to speak, with the farmer. And the farmer was, I think, basically looking at this as Liberty Hyde Bailey is saying, "I'm not smart enough to do what I'm doing effectively."
So what impact did he have on farmers? I guess I'm trying to get that sense. What did the work he did, how was that felt on farms, not only in Michigan, but across the country, ultimately?
Well, he brought that idea of new technology to farming. I mean, the number of handbooks that he wrote about farming is one of his key contributions. In fact, my wife's family that ran an orchard in rural Pennsylvania, their bookshelves are lined with Liberty Hyde Bailey how-to books, specifically on how to prune apple trees. So it was a very practical approach from a noted scientist to be able to help manage farms.
Basically, how to grow things better.
Yeah, how to grow things better, whether you have a garden plot or you have 80 acres.
How would you describe his agrarian ideology?
So this is my interpretation. I call it transcendental agriculture because he wrote a book called The Holy Earth, but it was very non-religious, you know, in the traditional Protestant or Catholic sense of the word. I call him the sort of the John Muir of the family farm. He was a contemporary of Muir. He was a true Jeffersonian when it came to the virtue of agriculture. He really believed firmly that our society would be at its best if we were operating on the rhythms of agriculture, using the best science, of course.
So how did actual farmers react to Bailey's notions, especially his enthusiastic, embrace of new technology?
I think there was skepticism because there was a fear of that new technology, especially around the turn of the century, would lead to centralization and overproduction.
Hmm.
And I think what's interesting about that fear of centralization and overproduction is that it actually happened. So here he was promoting science to the family farm. He was doing it because he didn't want the agriculture to be centralized and therefore create overproduction. And that's exactly what happened.
Interesting. So, and it's something that he did not envision, but that was the ultimate result. How long did it take for that to happen?
By the 1920s, he saw the handwriting on the wall. He had been appointed by Theodore Roosevelt to the Country Life Commission to try to study rural life. And by the 20s, he saw where agriculture was going with steam and gas technology getting into the fields. He sort of started to retreat. He had to choose at that point between holding up the family farm and scientific research. And he chose scientific research. He sort of retreated into academia, which at the beginning of his career was what he was trying to pull together to help the family farmer.
So it's safe to say Liberty Hyde Bailey and his theories really did change the face of farming in this country.
Yes, it did. Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm so interested in it. It's because what he wrote in the late 19th century and early 20th century is still relevant today. And it's interesting that more people don't talk about him. And, you know, you have authors like Michael Pollan and Wendell Berry that are holding up the value of good, solid food production and the community benefits of small-scale agriculture. And actually, Wendell Berry does cite Bailey quite a bit. So without Wendell Berry talking about him, he might be completely a footnote in history. But it's interesting that he's not talked about more.
And there is a Liberty Hyde Bailey Museum, is there not?
Yeah, in South Haven, Michigan. His home site is a museum. You can learn about his time in South Haven, but also a lot about his career as a botanist and as a scientist.
The legacy of the pioneering botanist and horticulturist Liberty Hyde Bailey, who was born 160 years ago this month in South Haven. State Archivist Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center, thank you so much for passing along your passion about Liberty Hyde Bailey.
Oh, thank you.
How do you know if nursing homes, home health aides, assisted living communities are treating you or your loved ones properly? And what do you do if they're not? We'll have that conversation on Stateside soon, but first, we need to hear from you. What questions do you have about the care you or a loved one is getting here in Michigan? What do you want to know that could improve elder care? Leave us a voicemail. Just call 734-764-7840. The number again, 734-764-7840. And you might hear your question next week on Stateside. There are many custom design and fabrication companies, but Urban Ashes is set apart with its motto, Reclaiming Trees and Lives. The Saline Company makes a wide array of items for business and homes, crafting products from wood carefully salvaged from abandoned homes and businesses in the Detroit area. And that once-forgotten wood is crafted by a once-forgotten workforce, ex-offenders, alongside young people close to falling into the very path that leads to jail or prison. Trees and lives reclaimed. Paul Hickman is founder, president, and CEO of Urban Ashes with us now. Paul, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So a custom design and fabrication company with a very deep social conscience.
You are correct. My background was more in the environmental aspect of it and the non-toxic finishes, locally sourced materials. That was my experience for well over 15, 20 years at that point. But then the social aspect of it that was instilled from the beginning was a key element, but it was not as much the focus, or at least not in the forefront of my mind. Now it is definitely the number one focus for us.
So how did that come to be? You start out, as you say, with a very clear idea of the kind of products you wanted to make and the way you wanted to make them.
Clear idea. Obviously, 3 years of R&D maybe finally got to a clear idea. The first 3 years, we were developing that quote-unquote clear idea. When we started, we focused on being a photo frame company. We were actually initially focusing on urban salvage wood, which is street trees, yard trees, storm damaged mm-hmm. trees, blight stricken trees, such as the Emerald Ash Borer, which is what we came out of. I helped start an organization in 2005 called the Urban Wood Project that has the Urban Wood Marketplace down in Recycle Ann Arbor and in multiple other locations around the state now. But it was growing every year, and after about 3 or 4 years, myself and one of the other founders, Jason Bing, got back together and wanted to come up with a product that we could scale nationally, because we were just touching the tip of the iceberg with selling product down at the reuse center. I had experience doing furnishings, restaurant retail interiors, and I'd also been doing a lot of work with my now 17-year-old. He was a lot younger then, but doing these collaborative prints, and we were doing our own frames. And I had a lot of experience with urban salvage wood, and I knew, going back to why we focused on photo frames for urban salvage wood, is because there's some innate characteristics you have to deal with that, and also feature. It's a double thing. You want to be able to feature them, but you also have some limitations in the fact that the trees are not as tall, a little shorter, a little squat. These are trees that are growing in your front yard that aren't necessarily fighting for light in a forested situation, so they lounge around a little bit more, which gives them some incredible character, but that character also generally leads to more difficulty in working with it, and also a much wider variety of character within the wood. So in the custom framing industry, one of the issues you deal with is that the wood needs to look pretty much like what you see up on the wall as a sample. In a photo frame industry, when you walk into a store, it's what you see is what you get. And so we started focused on that, and then evolved into doing the custom framing and moved across the country into about 240, 250 locations in 40 plus states now. And then very quickly within the first year, we started in 2009, but by 2010, 2011, we were introducing our denailed collection, which is what you referenced about wood coming out of houses and buildings in the Detroit metro area. That's even expanded. We've kind of outgrown the capacity, believe it or not, for Detroit to provide enough material. So our wood is coming from all over the state of Michigan, the deconstructed wood. Some of it's from Detroit, some of it's from up in the thumb, different parts around the state.
When did the light bulb go off in your mind that this work with this reclaimed wood was a perfect fit for giving jobs to returning citizens, people who had been incarcerated and were looking to rebuild their lives?
Probably the first time I worked side by side or saw some of our crew working and hearing their stories. You know, when you're not connected with it or it's not part of your story or directly, and it, oddly enough, over the years, I've learned my story is a whole lot closer than I initially realized. But once I got to meet some of these people, probably one of the very first ones, a guy named Calvin Evans, technically our first employee, who's now moved on to, he helped start a program and is running a program called DLive in Detroit, which is a violence intervention program that's doing incredible work in Detroit. But once I start hearing kind of their stories and working side by side with them, a lot of my stigmas and barriers and things that, you know, that have been implanted in me from society or whatever I had been exposed to started coming down. And I started thinking, you know, this is a pretty amazing dynamic that this is. It really took Mary King, who at the time was the head of the Michigan Prisoner Reentry Initiative for Washtenaw County and helped start it for the state. And Mary connected me with a lot of these guys. And Mary's the one who, you referenced our sort of tagline now, Reclaiming Trees and Lives. She said that in defining us one day in a meeting with me, she said, "You're reclaiming trees and lives." And I thought, wow, that's pretty heavy duty. And today it's still a hard thing for me to, you know, use that as our tagline, because to me it's such a bold statement. But in reality, I think our crew feels the same way. So if they're good with it, I'm good with it. Over the years that we've been doing this, I've been able to realize that, and these guys say it all the time, that working on the wood is like working on themselves, that they look at the wood as something that society typically would have discarded or had discarded, like their lives had been discarded, and they're working on themselves and creating a product in two products, one a product and a person that is now highly desirable.
This process, exactly. This working and then bringing in young people who are perhaps wandering down the wrong road and letting them be part as a mentor-mentee relationship with folks that have lessons to teach.
Correct. And that was another, and again, I don't know if there's happy accidents, or I think a lot of this is, you know, the circles you put yourself in and the circles you choose to go after. A year and a half ago or so, in the summer of 2016, mm-hmm. my oldest son, the one I was talking to about earlier, he and I were talking about looking for some work during the summer that wasn't just a typical summer job, that was some community service type thing. And we worked with a woman in Ypsilanti who has a program who's working with youth in high school and junior high school that have been struggling with their academics, and he went over as a tutor. And we got really busy that summer, and I started thinking, okay, this would be a good summer job for some of these kids. Maybe they would like to come over and work with us. And I called up Gail Wolkoff, who's the director of that, and asked her if, you know, she thought she might have a couple kids. And she said, "Oh, absolutely." And I think we got four. Several of them stayed on with us for upwards of a year, year and a half, and have moved on to some other things. But that connected us with this youth aspect that we didn't have really before. And what we started realizing is some of our older crew that had done time in prison. We have currently, we have two guys who did over 20 years in prison, and watch the dynamic happening in their engagement with the younger crew. I'll never forget one of the first guys who we'll talk to later, Drew, when he first came in. After he left, when we first met him, Rob said to me that was me at 17, and I didn't get any help, and just said, I'm not letting this kid go the same route as I did. And this kid's got similar attitude about life and things, and I'm going to work with this kid. And that, to me, clicked a light bulb. And we're speaking of light bulbs.
Yeah.
Definitely is like, okay, this is a dynamic that is really missing for both sides, because this is also now providing an opportunity for guys that have done their time in prison and paid their dues there, but really given back to society in a manner to kind of close.
I hear what you're saying. Pay old debts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And really and directly back to the area of community that they most impacted. They need to speak to that more than I do. I get to witness it and watch it from the outside, and it's amazing to watch.
After the break, we continue talking with founder of Urban Ashes, Paul Hickman, and then we'll talk with two employees, a mentor and his apprentice.
It's just been a great thing for me because it gives me a sense of pride, feeling I'm giving back to somebody that was potentially going on a wrong path.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now our conversation with Paul Hickman, the founder, president, and CEO of Urban Ashes. It's a custom design and fabrication company located in Saline, and it goes out of its way to reuse old wood for production and to hire workers with criminal records. So, Paul, what kind of reaction do you get from potential customers as they realize that the folks making these products have this kind of, as you say, a dual reclamation, trees and lives?
It's pretty amazing because there's an incredibly, unfortunately, incredibly high percentage of people that have had somebody really close to them in their life or themselves that have had issues or contact with the Justice Department or somebody whose family member has been incarcerated. And you just don't see too many instances where businesses or elements of society are really trying to reach out to that population. We have over 2 million people incarcerated in this country, and over 90-95% of them are going to come out at some point. What are we going to do as a society to reacclimate these people as citizens back? Because they're citizens just like us, and getting them back into society is going to take some effort, and it's going to take some understanding. But these people start to see that, and it's amazing. I guess what I was trying to say is that the customers that we work with, or we sell a lot of wholesale, and then they pass that on to their customers. So sometimes we don't get to see the final interaction, but it's a key part of our story, and they get to be part of that process and let them know in a sort of indirect way. It's direct, but it's kind of fed through the line that, you know, hey, we're here with you and we're supporting you on this, and we appreciate what you're doing and the work you're doing to reacclimate back into society and give back to society and be productive, which is, you know, a pretty amazing thing to be part of.
And you talked about what you used to carry before you began working with your team, with kind of old stigmas and attitudes. What do you want to say to potential employers who could be in the position of employing a returning citizen?
The way that I put this is why it's important to me to have sort of a clean slate, and I don't necessarily, legislation helps because legislation or policy sets a tone in society for us, and that's where I'm kind of feeding back on what is society sort of dictated as acceptable or the norm, and having somebody carry that stigma of being an ex-felon for the rest of their life, because it's a life sentence. You may get out of prison after 3 years, 5 years, 20 years, but you're going to carry that with the rest of your life. It is a scarlet letter that you will have to carry, and that's the way our society is set up now. And so looking to change that attitude and belief is monumental. Policy helps because policy sets a tone. However, in talking to businesses, I'm going to speak to businesses that if you don't truly consider interviewing and honestly interviewing people who are returning citizens, people coming out of the prison population, or youth that have had contact with the juvenile justice department, you are missing out on what I would say, my personal experience, arguably one of the most dedicated staff members you'll ever have. There was a really good, and I can't mention names of companies, but for example, we were in at a conference recently, and the head of HR for a double-digit billion-dollar international corporation said that if his company did background checks further than 10 years, he would have never been hired. And he was highly skilled. My point is that company didn't go back as far as they could have. And so that's standard. And they're looking to change even and get more aggressive in how they are, they're open, more of an open hiring practice. But we're missing massive amounts of opportunities here. But we have, particularly in the state of Michigan, we have an incredible drain on our talent pool. A lot of our youth are leaving. And so we've got this youth population that is chomping at the bit to work because most people aren't giving them the opportunity. And once you give these people the opportunity, the give back is pretty impressive. They understand that you gave them a chance where 100 others, and I'm often, you know, not exaggerating there, 100 other companies wouldn't even talk to them. Soon as they saw that they had a felony issue, or soon as they, you know, had these very, you know, see that these various issues as a juvenile, and some of them could be 20, 30, 40 years old convictions, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't even talk to them. Even though they were ready to hire them, they were excited about them for every other reason that they were highly skilled at it, that one element kicked them off. And I think it's a shame for the company. I think the company's missing out on a massive opportunity, a labor pool that is incredibly gifted and skilled, as well as probably more than anything. The most important thing to me when I'm hiring somebody is, what's your commitment going to be? And your commitment to learn and learn what we need at our company to do. And these folks have that commitment because a lot of them have missed a huge chunk of their life. They've got time that they're trying to make up.
So you have seen this whole concept grow from photo frames, picture frames, to something much bigger.
Correct. We went from photo frames to custom framing and slowly started introducing back in furniture elements, which was a passion of mine prior. And I built a little bit of a reputation as a furniture designer, but we focused on adding in commercial contract furnishings for restaurant, retail, and hospitality. Tabletops in particular, but also some other furnishings there. And then lastly, in the last 2 to 3 years, we've really been ramping up a lot of work with other companies all over the country doing OEM work where we're manufacturing. OEMs traditionally focused on the automotive industry or the tech industry, but we're basically producing a product that goes into a different finished product for another company. And that we're doing where we're sending out hundreds to thousands of frames at a time to one company, and then they're distributing, putting in their product. And then the two combined create a new product that are shipped out all over the country, actually all over the world.
And you've got commercial and residential. And I know if somebody's been down at the Detroit Foundation Hotel, for example, they've seen your work. You're all over custom tables and benches and picture frames and bar tops and wall cladding and materials. So it's really growing.
We are definitely growing, and that's a good thing. We have a lot of wood to keep out of the landfills and a lot of people to employ.
Paul Hickman, founder, president, and CEO of Urban Ashes. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And now we turn to a couple members of the Urban Ashes production team. Rob Richmond is a production manager and a mentor to younger workers. Rob, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Krzyzewski is a production worker and one of the younger team members who are being mentored. Welcome, Andrew, and thank you so much for being here with us.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Rob, I want to talk about your path to Urban Ashes and your life before you found this job.
Well, I grew up in Warren, Michigan, the youngest of six children. Grew up in an okay neighborhood. It was surrounded by a tank plant by the railroad tracks, kind of like a Stand By Me scenario with fields and stuff. And probably around the age of like 13 or 14, I started using drugs. My dad passed away, and I started smoking marijuana and drinking, and it just ultimately led to a path of destruction of my entire life.
Which led to what?
To when I was 19 years old, I was convicted of second-degree murder. I did 23 years and some months in prison for that and got out 3 years ago.
3 years ago. What was it like once you got out of prison and you wanted to start rebuilding your life, and finding a job is key to that?
Well, when I got out, I put in hundreds of applications, at least 120. Went to various interviews,
got some positive feedback, got, you know, I'm going to call you back, well, you'll hear from us, and then never hear from them. And, you know, I decided when I got out, because I changed my entire life and the way I think and the way I deal with stuff and the choices I make, obviously, that I was very honest and upfront with every employer. Like, this is what happened. I made bad choices when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I was trying to just be as upfront as possible to see my honesty in that I wanted to work and that I was reliable. And, you know, I even offered some employers, I'll work 2 days for free. If you don't like my work ethic, we can cut ties there. And there was a big issue of, as soon as I started being honest and telling them that I was a felon and trying to get my life together, I could see the switch turn off on a lot of people. I've had employers tell me to my face, you're a liability, I cannot hire you. We had a neighbor that lived across from me and my wife. He happened to be one of the retailers for Urban Ashes in Ann Arbor. And he actually talked to my wife about it before, but it was like building frames. I don't know nothing about building mm-hmm. frames. So finally I went and talked to him and asked him about, you know, what is this job opportunity? And he told me that, you know, it was Paul Hickman, that, you know, he actually hired felons and that wouldn't be a problem. So I emailed Paul. He probably about a week later emailed me back and called me in for an interview, and I talked to Calvin, who was the HR at that time, and got a job.
And how long have you been there now?
It's 3 years.
What do you like about the work?
Oh, the work is awesome. It's always different. It's always changing. We're always doing different projects. You're working with salvaged wood that otherwise would have been discarded, burned, throughout in the landfills or whatever. And we're taking this stuff that was going to be discarded and we're making beautiful furniture, beautiful frames, beautiful tables, you know, or other projects that Paul's designed.
And they're going all over the place and are going to last a long, long time, because you just look at the pictures of these, they're solid, beautifully made pieces.
Exactly. Yeah, it's wonderful. Mm. And I wouldn't trade it for the world.
And Andrew, you've just turned 18?
That is correct.
What was going on with your life before you came to Urban Ashes?
Before I'd come to Urban Ashes, I was involved in a program called Youth Build at Washtenaw Community College. It's a program that helps people who dropped out of high school get their GED, get some work skills, some construction certificates. It's a great program. After that, I'd gotten a call from my old probation officer, Gina Steffi, and she had asked if I was looking for a job in that field. And that another probation officer, Stephen Hall, he had been talking to Paul about hiring someone from the program I was in. And then, Steve connected me to Paul, and here I am.
Yep. Here you are. What was going on that brought you in contact with the justice system?
I'd ran away from home when I was 14, and there was a lot of chaos at my household, both households. My parents are divorced. More than anything, I think I just wanted to escape it. I didn't have anyone to talk to. School felt like it was just more pressure about it. So I'd connected with some people with similar mindsets, went into using drugs, breaking into houses, trying to get money for more drugs to eventually leave, drive away from the state, as if that would be better.
Sure.
But eventually I got arrested 3 times to be specific. The third time I couldn't pass a drug test. They were really shocked at how much THC was in my system. And they had sent me to a True North Treatment Center, which is right next to the juvenile detention at Washtenaw Ave. Mm-hmm. And I'd spent about 9 months in there, and it's an intensive program. There's 5 therapists. It's maximum security. I got to say, the food was pretty good. But after 9 months, I went into outpatient, and I started going back to school at Youth Build. And then I graduated probation.
And what do you like about the work you're doing at Urban Ashes?
Like Rob said, one of the biggest aspects is it's always changing. You know, there's not a whole lot of monotony with it. There's always a new stick or a new piece of wood or something else that needs to be done to this particular frame, this particular table. When I'm finished working with the wood, whether it be a frame of hard maple or a table of pine or some walnut, it's amazing just to sit there and look at, like, we have done this. From this that was all tarnished, torn up, it's going to get thrown away, and now it's this beautiful table that someone can use for who knows how long.
And you've got Rob as a mentor.
That is correct.
What does that mean to you?
Rob and another coworker, Aurelio, who are both have spent time in prison, they're really big inspirations to me. I've talked with them about a lot of subjects and situations in my life, and what they share with me and their experience, strength, and hope is something that really inspires me almost daily. As well, they can also teach me discipline as well with the job, you know?
They've been there.
Yeah.
Someone else can talk till they're blue in the face, but mm-hmm. they haven't been there.
That's correct.
And for you, Rob, as you see Andrew coming in, what were your thoughts when you met him?
When I met him, he was he reminded me of me. He was kind of a wall. It was even down to I was showing him something about sanding where he was like, just give me the sander, and like he was going to do it. And that's kind of the attitude I had, is I can do anything and I don't need no help. Andrew's really become like a right hand of mine in the shop. Him and I are always early, and we talk about personal stuff before our day even starts. It's just been like an awesome experience having somebody and seeing him change and seeing him gradually get better about a lot of things. You know, we all make mistakes in life, and usually we learn from them mistakes. And it's not that I point them out to him, but, you know, unless it's something on the wood, but on a personal level, like, we talk about the stuff and I tell him my experiences with whatever problems he's having. It's just been a great thing for me, because it gives me a sense of pride feeling I'm giving back to somebody that was potentially going on a wrong path. And I think with him, he was already on the right path before I even met him. Like, I see the change and the want to change and to be better in life in general from him. That's been a great experience.
You're kind of smiling. It's like, not like a dad, but kind of like a, what, friend, dad, uncle? What do you think when you think of Rob?
Rob.
Really quick, I did that first sand. You know I did a good job. But,
exactly, my point.
I look at Rob as definitely some kind of figure. I wouldn't say a father figure, but definitely someone I can look up to, and there's always something new every day I can take from his character. Same with Aurelio, same with all our other coworkers. I'm always looking for the best in people that I can apply to myself. Rob and Aurelio definitely have a certain kind of strength to make it through, you know, changing their lives and dealing with the mistakes they made. A lot of times it's overlooked, and I'm trying my hardest not to overlook it.
And how are you doing in your recovery from the drug and alcohol use?
Today I'm about 2 years and 3 weeks and I believe 6 days sober.
And I'm seeing a smile on your face.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And is this work a key part of that, the kind of things you're doing with your hands every day and coming in around this team?
Definitely. There's two main aspects. One is that there's always something to do. There's like a purpose every day. I wake up tired, nonetheless, but I wake up, I come to work, and it's like, okay, let's get this done. And then the second part is it's a daily reminder of myself.
Where do you see this young man, Rob? Where do you see him at your age?
I see him being highly successful because he's very driven. That's one of the things I admire about him. And I actually just had a conversation with another coworker about this the other day. As I said, I wish I was as driven and had my stuff together as much as he did. And he really focuses on education and stuff like that, that where I wasn't focused on that at that age. I was focused more on getting high and using drugs and stealing and whatever else to get more drugs. And I'm very proud of him and to know him.
Rob, what do you hope prospective employers will take away from this conversation that we're having right now and from what you and others at Urban Ashes have done?
Well, one of the things I really hope they take from this is that people make mistakes and bad choices early in their life. And, you know, a lot of the time we pay for them with a big part of our life. And the recidivism rate of people that do over 15 years is like below 7%. Mostly everybody I know that's done over that amount of time really are sincere about getting their life together. And I just hope that they'll give these guys another chance. And I mean, some of them will be the best employees you'll ever have. They're dedicated to getting their life together, and some of them are behind. So they work harder to make up for the lost time.
Well, congratulations to both of you on the beautiful products you're turning out at Urban Ashes and the work you're all doing with each other. We really want to thank you for sharing your stories with us.
Well, thank you for having us here.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Rob Richmond, who's a production manager, and Andrew Kucheski, production worker at Urban Ashes. And today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.